supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show. Last week, you'll remember we told you what a bad choice ornamental flowering pears are for your landscape. Well, this week, we're going to tell you how great edible pear trees are. We're going to tell you about the difference between Asian and European pears and get you started on your way to peachy pearness. Otherwise, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Catherine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. I just love your show. I listen to it every week on WHYY.
Could you be a little more enthusiastic, though, Kath? We really need, you know, somebody to be positive on it.
I'm sorry.
Don't you dare be sorry.
I am calling from Elkton, Maryland.
Elkton, Maryland. You went there to elope when you were 17 and you stayed forever, right?
Hardly. But it is a great place to live. And I am blessed to live on a couple acres. However, I've never been a gardener until about a year ago. And last week you discussed composting, which has always intrigued me. I'm ready to take the plunge into the great big world of composting, but I have questions and I'm hoping you can help me. Is it too late for me to start a compost pile in January?
Not if you saved leaves from the fall.
I did, and that was another question I had. Can I use last fall's leaves?
Everybody's using last fall's leaves. Those are the most recent leaves we have.
Well, groovy. Okay, so I have like piles of leaves in the backyard that have been dumped from the mower bag, so those are good to use.
Now the question becomes, I'm a little worried about any grass clippings if the lawn was treated with herbicides.
Okay, it was not.
Well, then you are composting, Catherine. You are close to...
I knew it.
You're close to being a master compostress or whatever.
Oh, may I put that on my resume?
I think so. Put it at the top. Now,
so the bottom leaves have already like turned this beautiful black color.
That's compost, baby.
Okay, so do I need to get those out in the spring when I start my garden?
No. I mean, if you want to go, yeah, I really wouldn't even recommend turning what you have out there, because I'm going to suggest that you did mix in a little bit of grass clippings with the shredded leaves as you were getting the leaves up very intelligently. That's one of the best ways to get your leaves up and get them shredded in one pass. And the best compost is made by combining well-shredded carbon. The best carbon is fall leaves and a little bit of nitrogen. In my home, I mostly use coffee grounds to mix with my shredded leaves. But for people who have big lawns, to let the lawn get a little high, let the leaves fall on it, and then to bag up that mixture of nitrogen-rich, fresh green grass clippings and dry shredded leaves, that is the premium compost recipe. You can't do better than that, because as you're mowing your lawn and your leaves, everything's getting mixed together, which also increases the composting capacity, and it betters the result. You probably generated heat in that pile. You could probably either see steam rising from it.
Yes, actually, when I turned it, I wanted to see what it was doing. So when I investigated it with a pitchfork a couple weeks ago before the snowfall, there was steam. And it was kind of exciting.
And so you've already turned it once.
Well, but unintentionally. I just wanted to see what it was doing.
Okay. Well, a lot of people would tell you to turn it once or twice over the winter. What I'm going to say is I think because you put together the perfect mixture up front, I would just leave it be And in the spring, when you're ready to use your finished compost, you'll go out with that pitchfork and you'll pull away all the uncomposted material, all the stuff that still looks like shredded leaves.
Right.
And on the bottom, you are going to have a gigantic pile of rich black compost.
Oh, my goodness. So I didn't even know it, but I have compost for my garden next year. Now, what about for the kitchen scraps? Do you recommend the trash can composting?
No, I recommend you get an indoor worm bin for your kitchen scraps.
I've been looking at those.
I've had one for a year now, and I don't know what I did without it. I keep yelling at myself, I wish I had had my worms years ago. They're like having kittens around. They're so much fun to watch. They really transform worthless kitchen garbage into fabulous soil, and you already have the perfect compost pile. Keep doing what you're doing every fall. Mow the grass and the leaves together and pile that up. Don't dare put any garbage in it. You'll just slow it down.
Okay, super. So for my garden, I'm using the outdoor stuff, but I'll get the worm bin inside, and I'll just pop it in the pantry.
And then the castings that you'll get from that, they will turn the garbage into what looks like compost. That's what you'll spread around your plants for a mid-season boost, or just when you see a plant that you think needs a little feeding.
Well, I just feel like I have gone to composting school now. I am ready to start the season.
You will have the best pile in your neighborhood.
Yahoo!
All right, Catherine?
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, good luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Lola, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Lola. Where are you?
I'm in Philadelphia.
Where?
I'm in East Oak Lane section of Philadelphia.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Lola in East Oak Lane?
Well, I have a bell pepper plant that I purchased about 2 summers ago,
right,
and it's still alive and producing peppers.
Indoors?
Indoors. Yeah, I brought it out. It was outside on the patio when I first bought it, and then I brought it in when the weather turned cooler, and I had it out last summer also, so it's in the house now.
Right.
And I have two questions. Well, first of all, I didn't know that bell pepper plants grew like that. I thought they were annuals and they just produced and died. And then the other thing is, I'm wondering if those peppers are safe to eat. I have been nibbling on them, but I've been a little afraid. Are they still safe to eat after all of these seasons?
They are perfectly safe to eat.
Oh, okay. That's good to know.
I perennialize my peppers as well.
Oh, okay.
Should you ever vacation down in especially New Mexico, you will see habanero trees that are 10, 15, 20 years old that have, and you've noticed this, your pepper plant, as it's gotten older, no longer has a green stem, right? It's
right.
Nice and woody like a little tree or a shrub.
Yes, right.
We call peppers annuals the same way we call bedding plants like impatiens and annual begonias, annuals, but in truth, they are not. They are frost-sensitive perennials that typically do die when the weather gets cold, but unlike a true annual, like a tomato plant, which you cannot carry for years and years, they do have like a genetic time bomb. At the end of a season, they're done. But peppers can live for 10 or 20, 30 years.
Wow, I didn't know that.
The one thing with peppers that I always advise people is wash them down really good before you bring them inside at the end of the summer.
Yes.
Because aphids do like to hitchhike on them.
Yes, I did do that.
Well, then you're perfect.
All right.
And the fact that obviously they're getting a lot of sun inside if they're continuing to bloom and
good
produce fruit. Not only is the fruit edible, but you will find as your pepper plants get older, you'll get ripe fruit faster.
Yes, I'm noticing that. Now, one thing, I get a lot of little blooms, and some of the blooms they just kind of dry up and drop off.
Right.
So I don't get as many as I did when I first bought the plant. But I am still, I'll get two or three every now and then, and I take them off when they get a nice size. They're smaller, too. They only get to be about maybe an inch and a half in diameter now.
And the ones in the summer, they get bigger?
Yeah, the bigger, yeah.
And do you keep it in the pot over the summer?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good, good. If your indoor area can accommodate it, you might want to, next season, when you put it outside for the spring,
yes,
you might want to plant it up into a bigger pot.
Oh, yeah.
That'll allow it to grow bigger peppers. Mm-hmm. But everything you're talking about is absolutely normal. We don't notice so much when flowers don't become a pepper outdoors because we're not paying that close attention.
Right.
But that's not unusual. With pepper plants, typically every fourth flower or so will produce a viable pepper. But indoors, keep it away from cold air and warm air. Keep it away from any kind of draft. Make sure it gets as much sun as possible.
Yeah.
Turn it frequently so that every side gets sun, and only water when the pot feels light so that you don't accidentally waterlog the plant. Never let any water collect in the saucer underneath.
Okay. All right. That's good to know.
And you're getting fresh fruit indoors locally over the winter.
Well, all right then. I'm glad to get that information. I enjoy your show very much.
And I enjoy hearing about peppers growing in the winter. It makes me happy.
Oh, okay.
Take care, Lily.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners with pansies in the ground that the boughs of cut Christmas trees make a great springy protection when ice and heavy snow events are predicted. Just prune off entire boughs, keep them at the ready, and then gently drape them over your pansy plantings right before the icy event and uncover them afterwards. But don't you go cutting up Christmas trees to protect your edible flowers just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and pears for your backyard. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, people are always asking what is the easiest fruit they can grow. I'm here to tell you right now, it's not apples and it sure ain't peaches. But pears just might be something the typical homeowner can get away with without a lot of work. We'll tell you all about it and the important difference between Asian and European varieties later in the show. In the meantime, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jane, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jane. How are you?
I'm pretty good, and how are you?
Very fine. And where is Jane pretty good?
Well, I'm in the Germantown section of Philadelphia.
One of our oldest and most distinguished neighborhoods.
Yes.
What can we do for Jane in Germantown?
Well, it's an ethical question about the Japanese purple-leafed honeysuckle, whether to plant or not to plant.
Well, you know the official answer, don't you, Jane, or else you wouldn't know it was an ethical question.
Yes, I think I'm not supposed to plant it.
Most honeysuckles, you know, all the native honeysuckles are very well behaved. They have beautiful flowers, but they don't have the smell that many people, as soon as you said the word honeysuckle, mm-hmm. could smell that. Nor are they so rich with nectar. The children can famously, like, tip a flower over and get a mouthful of honey.
Right.
That is the Japanese honeysuckle, which is not the most invasive plant on the planet, but it is in the top five. So, you know, have you asked other people about this?
Yes. My brother, who is a Pennsylvania forester, told me that it's illegal to sell it and it can't be planted.
So you don't have it then? You were, where were you going to get it, on the black market for
honey?
No,
someone, a garden greenhouse place sold it to me. Or that they, I'm sorry, they didn't sell it to me. They gave it to me.
Oh, your story's changing. Don't, you know, the regular listeners know that my father was a homicide detective while I was growing up. And I think we want you to hang around the station for a while now, Jane. We have some more questions we want to ask you. So it appears somebody broke the law. And your brother's a forester?
He is, and he told me not to plant it.
Where is your brother now?
He's in Perry County.
In Pennsylvania. That's
yeah,
a very rural
county. He's in the rural section right now.
So he's out being one with the forest.
Yes.
Do you think we could reach him?
Yes. Yes, you could.
We're going to take you off the air for a minute.
Sure.
Give our producer his phone number. Okay, you guys got the number? Okay, they got the number. Now, Jane, what situation is your honeysuckle in now? Is it in pots? Have you already planted it? Have you already?
I put it in my sun porch.
Okay. And how's it doing indoors?
It seems to be happy.
Is your brother's name Bob?
Yes.
Bob, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Bob, what do you think about your sister being a master criminal here?
It in the house. Don't let it escape.
Now, you're in Perry County, which is a very rural area of Pennsylvania. Are you looking at the damage done by honeysuckle right now, even though it's in the middle of winter?
Well, actually, I'm my home and my office is in York County. I'm just in the woods working on a property in Perry County at the moment. And this particular woodlot, no, I don't see any of the, you know, that type of honeysuckle here, but there are invasives in most of our woods. They are a problem.
And Bob, you understand the attraction of the Japanese honeysuckle, that amazing fragrance.
I'll take your word for it.
But you've seen it may or may not displace native species, but it certainly grows totally unchecked once birds deposit the seeds, I presume, out in the forest somewhere.
That is correct, yes. It's very prolific.
Now, your sister clearly has identified that she's in a very natural area where this kind of thing should not be planted. I mean, bamboo is a menace, but it's only a menace as far as it can go by foot. The problem with honeysuckle and these other invasive vines is birds eat the seeds, and then they can plant this stuff all throughout the state, and they don't respect state lines. They'll be dropping it in Jersey. And it sounds like the area that she's describing is exactly the kind of place honeysuckle should not be anywhere near.
In a native, you know, outside environment, yes, I would agree totally.
So are you going to keep an eye on her, Bob? Are you going to?
I will.
Are you going to go out? Do you have a honeysuckle detector? Do they issue that?
No. We've just learned to identify it. That's all. There's plenty of invasives that you see, that we see.
Okay, so Jane, you got two against, and there is no third judge in this boxing match. Are you going to try to keep the plants alive inside?
Oh, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that.
Well, as long as you would keep them inside, you know what you could do? And this would be a flower show trick. And I would urge you to visit the Philadelphia Flower Show the first week in March and talk to some people there who are masters at this.
Okay.
But I bet you could put the pots in cold storage for X amount of weeks or months. Bring them out. Expose them to sunlight in that great sunroom of yours and mm-hmm. give them lots of support. And it's possible you could get them to bloom inside.
Hmm.
But I think they would need a chilling period. I'd ask Bob, but I don't think he knows anything about keeping honeysuckle alive. Right, Bob?
That's correct.
So I would try to force it. I would give it a cold treatment and then expose it to bright light indoors. And see what happens. But for God's sakes, don't let any birds fly out of into your house and then leave alive.
No, I don't like birds in my house.
Good.
I hate birds in my house.
Good. And Bob doesn't want to see any honeysuckle outside your house.
Right.
Okay, guys?
Well, thank you so much.
All right. Jane and Bob, thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. You behave yourself, Jane.
I'm going to try.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob, too.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Genevieve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I love your name, Genevieve. Where are you?
Oh, thank you. Oh, I'm in Philadelphia.
Okay, well, you know, that demands the follow-up question. Where?
We're right on the border between, like, Fishtown and Port Richmond.
Okay.
So we're ways up there.
You are in that area of the city where Center City has expanded outward into Northern Liberties and is now pushing into the communities that were home to the kids I went to high school with at North Catholic.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
You're from around here. Oh, wow.
Bridget Tarsdale, yo.
Oh, there you go. So we just bought a house here, and it came with this really beautiful garden in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And it has roses and irises and everything. And when we saw it, we thought, awesome, we're going to put in a little vegetable garden. Actually, the lady before us had one there. And when we were signing our papers with her, she said to make sure that we put out a lot of bird seed for the birds because they'll eat your vegetables, which I had never really heard before. And I thought that was really weird. But we signed and we moved in. And when we got here, I was out and I was kind of cleaning up for the winter, the garden, and I noticed all these holes and in the ground. And in my naivete, I thought they were groundhogs, but it turned out she was feeding a whole family of rats. So we have rats in our garden, and it's a lot of rats. So we called Philadelphia Pest Control. I don't know what I thought they were going to do, but they put a lot of poison down there, like bags and bags of poison. So my guess is that the rats are pretty well dead. However, I'm really concerned about two things. One is that the soil's been wrecked, and the other thing is that if I do put in vegetables, are the rats going to come back?
Rats are a very common problem in the inner city and urban areas. They can actually become a problem out in the country as well. They are one of mankind's greatest threats. They're always there at the outskirts trying to come in and very specifically eat our lunch. This is the first time in 25 years in this business I've heard of a gardener keeping rats. This is a first. The first thing you want to do is get out there and excavate it. And, you know, get gloves and get a mask. It's good to do this in the winter while everything's still cold because you don't want an entire colony of dead rats under your soil when the weather warms up. Not for any horticultural reasons, but for sitting outside reasons. This is why I always beg people not to feed birds with seed because this isn't the inevitable result. And then what I suggest anyway, urban soils are terrible. You don't want to be growing food in urban soils. I mean, the possibility of it having been contaminated with lead paint or any of dozens of other toxins is too high. And it's probably, even if she was a good gardener, it's probably not that good. So after you get rid of your former vermin, what I would do is tamp the soil down real hard. And then build some really nice raised beds, like 4 foot wide. and as long as the space accommodates, make sure you always have 2-foot walking lanes to go around them. You can build them with pavers. They look very good in these little backyards, or you can use any kind of untreated wood. And then fill them up with a nice mix of topsoil and compost. You'll love growing in raised beds. And I don't want you growing in that soil, even if the city hadn't come out. But if anything like this happens again, what you just do is you get what's called a have a heart trap. You can get them at any hardware store. And then you can trap them and then do whatever you think is appropriate with them. They also make, listeners have turned me on to this, it's relatively new, they also make electric mouse and rat traps now, where the animals go in and are instantly electrocuted. And a little light goes on. And they're not expensive. You can look online. They're called rat zappers. And a little light goes on when you got to catch. And so you can just turn your head to the side, dump it in a trash can, and not look at it.
Oh, can you reuse it? Is it a reusable thing? Oh, that's good. All right. You said with the raised beds, how high up do those have to be?
Well, as high up as you want to make them. A foot is the general minimum. And anything beyond that saves your back. You'll never go back after you grow in raised beds. You'll never want to grow in flat ground again.
Okay. All right. Good to know. That's great. Thanks so much.
All right. Good luck and have a rat-free garden in the future.
Okay. I will. Okay. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ann, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you, Mike?
I'm doing good, Ann. How are you?
Good.
And where is Ann good?
I live in Morristown, New Jersey. However, I'm calling regarding a summer property that we have in Beach Haven, New Jersey, which is on Long Beach Island.
Is it still there?
So needless to say, Hurricane Sandy did a number on everybody down there. And our yard had about 2.5 to 3 feet of water. And it came from both the bay and the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that there was salt in that water. And I also think it was some contamination in there. I mean, it just picked up everything that went along.
You have to assume anytime there's a big flooding event that the sewage system is going to back up and that stuff is going to mix in with any kind of seawater or bay water. So, yes, anytime you get inundated like that and there's standing water, you should always presume the worst. That's very smart.
What do I do? Do I have to replace the soil? My main concern is my vegetable garden. And I use mushroom soil in there. Usually every year I replenish that.
Okay, good.
And I have a great garden. I have a banner crop every year. But I'm afraid now that if it's contaminated, I can't really grow food in there, can I?
Well, yes and no. The important thing for all of the poor people who got visited by Sandy, and especially who got hit with a lot of seawater, is as soon as it's feasible, what you want to do is flush your soil with clean water, as much clean water as you can to get the salt out of it. That'll also start to wash out some of the contaminants.
Okay.
Now, I presume you started with very sandy soil, and by adding all this mushroom soil, which is a form of compost to it, you've got a very rich soil that drains very well.
Right.
Are you growing in flat ground?
Yes.
Well, I think this is the year for you to build some raised beds to grow in, because I would like to avoid this soil for the first year, but you already have a big supply of mushroom soil coming in most years, right? Good age mushroom soil.
Right.
Take a look at the garden area, and I want you to create lanes that are 4 feet wide. They can be as long as you want. Block them off. You can use a pavers or stone or just the cheapest non-treated wood you can find and build them up about 1 foot high.
Okay.
And make sure you have 2 feet of walking lane in between each raised bed. And the reason the raised beds are 4 feet wide is you're not going to walk on that soil where your plants are. That's just going to be for their roots.
Okay.
You'll notice a tremendous improvement in production in the health of your plants.
Okay.
And then before you fill these beds, put down a single layer of cardboard over the entire bottom of the bed. Matter of fact, you can even extend the cardboard into the walking lanes and then cover it with a little bit of wood chips or something so it doesn't get muddy.
Okay.
And this way, you know, raised beds are the way to go anyway, especially as we get older. It's better for the plants. It creates a more structured garden. And again, with them being 4 feet wide and with you having 2 feet lanes in between, you can reach the center of the bed without stepping in. Once you fill these beds with your beautiful mushroom soil, you're never going to step into them. You'll walk in the lanes and you'll tend the plants, and the cardboard will isolate the roots of your plants from any contamination.
Okay. So I don't have to remove any of the existing soil, just flush it out really good.
Flush it out with water and then grow on top of it. It gets really expensive to remove soil like that. It's much better to just kind of like do what they do with a landfill, cap it off and grow on top.
All right.
Okay?
Thank you. Yes, thank you. You saved me from buying a lot of soil.
Yeah, well, you're still going to buy some soil, but now I think it'll be a much smaller amount. And you'll have a dedicated garden with many fewer weed problems. And I'm sorry about the devastation. I mean, good luck rebuilding, and Jersey will always come back.
It does. They're strong people.
All right, good luck, Ann.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners who had a big amaryllis blooming for the holidays that now is the time to try and get it ready for a second round of flowers. After the blooms are done, clip off the top of the flower stalk and move the plant into the brightest light you have. Feed it with a gentle, non-smelly organic fertilizer, then take it outside when the weather's warm enough for tomatoes. In late summer, put the bulb in a cool, dark place with no food or water for 3 months, and it'll be ready to bloom again. But don't go looking for all these details in the A to Z Answers section of our archives just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and why you need a pair to get pears. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll explain why pears may be the easiest big fruits a gardener can grow. We'll tell you about a pair of pears, and we'll also tell you why you need a pear to get pears. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Mark, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
Well, I'm in the rhododendrons.
And where is Mark in the rhododendrons?
I'm in the path of Hurricane Sandy in beautiful Trenton, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. And I'm going to surmise that Sandy, that bully, knocked over one of your roadies?
Yes, we have two that face east and provide some great shade to our front porch. They're about 10 feet tall. They'd be much taller if I didn't prune them back regularly.
Right.
One of them went over, and I've been trying to prop it back up. I've had no luck whatsoever. I guess the canopy of the bush is just catching too much wind, and in one case, too much snow, and continues to topple over, and I'm wondering if there's any way I can save it.
Well, you know, that's very interesting that you say that, because one thing I've noticed in the aftermath of Sandy, we've had a lot of windy days.
And wind from a different direction than normal. I think we've had a lot of north. East wind that's been, you know, kind of weakening things. I know.
It's got people worried. My neighbor, Jor-El, he put his infant son in a rocket ship and sent it off to this other planet. You know, it's just luckily the Science Council won't listen to him. You know? Well, you got two choices here. It sounds like nature is trying to tell you to take a break. So how tall is this rhododendron?
It's about, it's touching the gutter on the porch, so it's 10 feet easy.
Okay. Rhododendrons and azaleas are very shallow-rooted plants. It's very surprising to people because the rhododendrons especially can grow so large. Do you have a lot of exposed roots showing?
There were a couple of days when it had fallen over and I didn't have a chance to get it propped back up and get the roots, you know, tucked under some soil. So there's a chance that I ran some risk of some frost on the roots.
Okay, so is it up or down now?
It's up right now, but right. That could be temporary. I've put some rebar in the ground and got some vinyl cord trying to hold it in place, but I'm not optimistic. I'm wondering if I should really cut it back or...
You could cut it back now. My answer would be always to let it bloom first.
Okay.
And then cut it back at the right time, because you know that is the right time to cut back rhododendrons.
Right, right.
So... You have it standing up, and it's supported by rebar and wrapping, but nothing that's binding into the trunk of the plant or anything.
No, I was very careful about that.
What I would do is I would go out, and I would get a nice load of compost or screen topsoil, mm-hmm. neither of which is easy to find in the winter, but I would do it, and I would really pile that up over top of the root system of the plant.
Okay.
If you can find it, I would get a big bale of peat moss and spread like an inch of peat moss all around the base of the plant to help the soil stay nice and acidic where it likes. And then ideally cover that with like 2 inches of compost. If it were still on its side, I would suggest we do this just with the root system, what's called healing in, just covering the root system completely with soil. And believe it or not, the plant would probably bloom on its side.
Huh.
But if it falls down again, that's what I want you to do. Just cover the root system with peat moss and compost. But for now, it sounds like it's well jury-rigged. Cover the root system really well with peat moss, then cover that with compost. If we get dry over the winter, don't be afraid to water it. Because with the winds we've had, that's also desiccating plants, whipping the moisture out of them. And that's one of the big dangers. And then in the spring, if its roots were only sideways for a couple of days, I think this thing could bloom for you. Have a heavy hand with the water. Have a heavy hand with covering the root system for now.
Okay.
And then after it blooms, then, you know, the rule is a third, but it can be a big third that you can cut it back by.
All right.
And then essentially just replant it. With a mulch of peat moss compost. Get some guys to come and make the hole bigger and everything like that.
Okay. Good.
All right. And then for the rest of the season, stay away from the root system to allow it to heal. But again, peat moss, compost, and water.
Understood. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, Mark.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Catalina, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. What a great name.
Thank you.
Where are you?
I am in Hatboro, North Philadelphia suburb.
So what can we do for Catalina in Hatboro?
I have a problem with scale. And the way this came about was about a year ago. First of all, I initially thought it was powdery mildew. That will tell you how much of a newbie I am.
That's why shows like mine are valuable, because you need the context to understand what's happening. So you're talking about outdoor plants.
Exactly, yes. Everything is outdoor, and I should mention also that my garden has various degrees of shade all throughout, but it's basically a shade garden at all points. The plant I'm the most concerned about is a skip laurel.
Oh, okay.
However, it originated on Henry Garnet Itea, I believe it's called, about a year and a half ago.
So the scale first showed up on what kind of a plant?
It's I believe it's called Itea, Henry Garnet.
Okay.
Sweet Spire, I believe it's the popular name.
Okay, Sweet Spire.
Yes.
Okay.
So, and at that time, I thought it was powdery mildew. Didn't give it much attention. Eventually, half a year later, this past spring, I used some daconil on it. Half of the plant died.
Yeah, I was going to say, and you took a year off your life as well.
Exactly. And at the same time, I saw it on lilac. And on lilac, some very old lilac also had very bad effect. Like, basically, my lilacs died this year, but they were extremely old.
Well, it's not because they were old. They're real drama queens. They like a lot of sun, and they like a lot of airflow, and it sounds like your garden is shady and crowded.
Right.
So that's not a good place for most flowering plants, but lilacs are going to be the first. Now, the scale you're talking about, is it mostly on the trunks and the branches? Are you seeing this on the leaves and the needles?
It's mostly on the branches. It started, I could see it spreading throughout this year.
Okay.
So it started kind of on the main branches, and then now it's more towards the leaves.
Okay, so let's try to figure out what's going wrong. Do you feed these plants?
I used to. The last year, I didn't. I put some leaf mulch, like basically ground up leaves from my own garden.
That's fine.
Sometimes I put some... It's good for azaleas, and it's a bit acidic fertilizer.
So halitone.
Halitone, exactly.
Yes. Okay. Well, that won't harm any plants. That's a pretty natural fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised, because I expected you to be feeding the heck out of these plants with chemicals, because that generally attracts scale. So outside of maybe pruning a little bit to increase the airflow, it doesn't sound like you're doing anything wrong. Now, you know, plants in shade should be fed more lightly than plants in sun, and they require less water.
That's an excellent tip. I thought the otherwise.
No. Well, plants in the shade are growing more slowly, so they can't process food as much, and they don't use as much water.
Okay.
So have a light hand with the food and water. And then I want to try a two-pronged attack on the scale. Now, the first thing I want you to do is go out and buy a load of suet feeders. And you're going to hang those all around the affected plants. The suet will attract wrens and chickadees and nutthatches and all these other carnivorous birds that will feed on the young versions of the scale before they develop their bony armor.
Okay.
So I want you to put up suet feeders for the winter, but stop feeding as soon as the weather warms up.
Okay.
Once the weather warms up, you want the birds to be scouring up and down the trunks of your trees, which they will be. The suet will make them used to coming in. And then maybe before you put up the suet feeders, you should go out and buy a dormant oil. A dormant oil is a refined horticultural product that smothers insects, very specifically scale. I think horticultural oil was developed for scale. And in the dead of winter, it's safe to spray a dormant oil, which is a heavy oil. That will smother these creatures by cutting off their ability to breathe through their exoskeletons. In the spring, I want you to let the birds go at it. And then as we get later into the spring, if the scale isn't being controlled, I want you to go out and buy a different horticultural oil, what's called a light summer oil. And that'll be a refined vegetable oil, but it does the same thing. Between the meat-eating birds and judicious use of horticultural oils, I think you'll be fine, especially because it doesn't sound like you've been doing anything wrong. If you were feeding with chemicals, if you had wood mulch piled up around it, then I would blame you. But it sounds like you just got nailed. And the fact that you have fairly natural conditions makes me confident we can get rid of this problem pretty quickly.
Thank you very much. This was very helpful.
All right. Good luck.
Hopefully it'll get better. Thank you.
Take care.
Goodbye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Pears, easy to grow, but so many choices. Larry Roebling, producer of You Bet Your Garden, read and explain a little bit about this week's question.
Well, in our last thrilling episode, we had to tell fruit-anxious Melinda in Hampton, Virginia, that her Cleveland pear tree was an ornamental that would never bear fruit. Well, crap, says Melinda. I got it on sale. The guy there said they were, quote, good pear trees for this area. Who wants a pear tree without fruit? I have enough fruitless stuff. All right, Mike, what is a good fruiting pear tree for my region? Or should I ask my local extension office and not pester you? Thanks.
Well, you're never wrong to ask your local county extension agents about the best varieties for your region. They're the experts on which plants are best adapted to your climate. Where they often let people down is with depressingly incorrect chemical-heavy recommendations about fertilizer and highly toxic advice on pest and disease control. So they can certainly help pick the plant, but afterwards you should use the organic information in our abundant A to Z archives to take care of the poor thing. Now, there are two types to choose from, Asian and European, each of which produce a distinctively different kind of pear. And you need to plant at least two different varieties to get fruit. Now, Asian and European trees typically bloom at such different times that they can't pollinate each other. And some Europeans will not successfully pollinate other Europeans. So you're not just choosing a single tree. You have to have at least two, and they must be good co-pollinators. Research this well carefully before planting, weed hopper. The good news is that pears are a fairly easy grow when it comes to pest and disease issues. Their biggest problem is a disease called fire blight, which we'll get to in a moment. For now, here's a little bit about the two types from our resident fruit expert Lee Reich's latest book, Grow Fruit Naturally. European pears, explains Lee, are the kind you're most likely to see in the supermarket. Pear-shaped with a flavor he describes as buttery, sweet, and richly aromatic. European pears can be grown in the absolute coldest regions, and they're available on dwarfing rootstocks that can keep the trees to a manageable size. Standard pear trees grow very large. But harvesting them is an acquired art at best. To enjoy their fullest flavor, Lee explains that European pears must be picked before they're ripe, properly cold stored, and then warmed at room temperature before eating. In describing this endless struggle to achieve perfect ripeness, Lee quotes Ralph Waldo Emerson, who once noted that there are only 10 minutes in the life of a pear when it is perfect to eat. To which Lee responds, but what a sensuous 10 minutes. Asian pears are also very cold hardy, but trying to grow them on a dwarfing rootstock is not recommended. However, Lee says they're still a good choice for a small landscape, as these trees put so much energy into producing fruit that it naturally keeps them to, quote, a manageable size. Some Asian pears are pear-shaped, but most are round like an apple. And like apples, all Asian pears have a crisp flesh that, says Lee, explodes with juicy flavor when you take a bite. Lee stresses that unlike the European varieties, Asian pears are left on the tree until they're ripe and must be thinned aggressively when the fruits are small to get good flavor.
And we also heard from Amy in Grand Traverse County, Michigan. She writes, we accidentally introduced fire blight into our orchard when we planted some pear trees this spring, discovering too late that one of them was infected. The Typhoid Mary tree was a Bartlett, which did not survive. We have cut the other trees that were infected back hard to stop the spread, burning the diseased parts. Now, we really want some Bartlett's as we love them canned for the winter, but have read in two books that pears have a weakness for fire blight and Bartlett is one of the most susceptible. Is this true? Can you suggest a couple of varieties that may be more resistant than others, especially of the canning variety? Thank you.
Well, in that same newest book, Growing Fruit Naturally, Lee describes Bartlett as productive, reliable, and very susceptible to fire blight, a bacterial disease that, yes, pears have a distinct weakness towards. It curls the stems and makes the leaves look like they've been singed in a fire. Lee says that the best defense is diligent pruning of affected branches, but conservative thinning of healthy ones. In addition, overfeeding favors the disease, so use very little fertilizer. In fact, Lee suggests letting grass grow all the way up to the base of susceptible trees to suck up any excess water and nutrients if those trees seem to be growing too vigorously. Now, Lee explains that the variety Harrow Delight has a flavor that's similar to Bartlett while being resistant to fire blight. But for canning, he highly recommends Kefir, a well-known European-Asian hybrid. It's very disease-resistant, and while it doesn't have the best fresh taste, it's said to be excellent for cooking and jarring up. Well, that sure was some interesting information about growing pears now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over at your leisure. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to put my pears in a can if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please, please tell us where you live and put the actual subject of the email in the subject line. And perhaps check Foist to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to this question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like the one you were going to send an email about, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Watch the video of my recent TEDx talk, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook, where we post new content every day or close to it. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminati. Larry Roebling continues to do a juicy job as our substitute producer, while Alexis Landis, who normally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, continues her maternity leave. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, does not care for canned pears. Our production assistant, Brett Rader, is a secret heavy syrup sucker. Our esteemed editor, Al Banks, says, free the canned pears. I'm your man with the opener, Mike McGrath, and I'll pop the top in time to see you again next week. Do you have spring bulbs that didn't make it into the ground last fall? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal what you can do to successfully bloom those neglected tulips, daffodils, and crocus. Plus your fabulous phone calls.